We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have you here on the program, somebody who has a lot of experience, many years of experience in the field of broadcast news. Rick Kaplan is his name. He has worked at CBS, ABC, MSNBC, and CNN US. Has been in business for a long time, has worked with a lot of very significant people, Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings, Ted Koppel, Katie Couric, just to mention a few. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois and on a regular basis over the years spends time on the campus working with journalism students. And we're pleased that he could be here on the program. He's also occasionally come and sat with us and talked just a little bit about broadcast news and about politics. And we're pleased that he could be here and spend some time with us as he is here this fall. Questions, comments are welcome, as always. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions welcome. We hope people can be brief, but we just ask that so we can keep things moving along. Anybody wants to call, they can certainly do that. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I guess the thing I didn't mention is you're just fairly recently, back in May, ABC hired you back, and you're now the executive producer of This Week with Christian Amanpour?
Executive producer of This Week with Christian Amanpour, and I'm in charge of political
also
coverage
heading up political
for the network.
For the network.
It's 16 weeks now.
Yeah. I don't hardly know where to start. I guess the thing that I wanted to ask you about was having been now working in television news, going back to the time when it was not your first job, but your second job, I think, when you were working with Walter Cronkite on the CBS Evening News, the business has changed tremendously, and I think
radically.
Some people would say not for the better over that time. What I wonder is what thing, and when you look at the changes, what things make you most happy or you think are best for the news business, and which drive you nuts?
Well, you know, people, when they look back, always tend to trash what's going on now. It's always better the way it was, mm-hmm. and it's always harder the way it is. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the fragmentation, all the new channels. I mean, there were three networks. That was it when I was starting, and having only three networks meant we never even looked at the ratings. I mean, I was doing the CBS Evening News. I think we had a 50 share, and we didn't care. So I had no idea what our ratings were because we had all the ratings, and there were only the three networks. Now there are 82 different pay channels, and at any given time there are 7 or 8 news channels on while we're on the air, and the fragmentation is amazing. One rating in the demo or 2 rating in the demo is, well, you know, we're really doing well. This is going good. And that's frustrating. That's really kind of frustrating. The audience levels, our expectations are way lower than they used to be. So that's, I don't like that. I don't like the idea that people have found so many other sources. They come back to the networks because ultimately they know that we are more reliable. With all that said and done about mainstream media and all the rest, they know that mainstream media and especially the broadcast networks are the most reliable sources of news that they can get. On the other hand, as a regular source of news, people find a million other things to do, and they go online and they wander around and they have a great time with search. They go to Google and Yahoo, people we made a deal with. Now, what's exciting about all this is we're all evolving into a more digital internet kind of world, and as the technologies evolve and we're able to expand more, there are great vistas, you know, great new challenges and great things we can do to bring more information to people, more news to people, and that's kind of interesting and that's kind mm-hmm. of exciting, and it's more exciting how we can, you know, all this technology allows us to bring more news and allows us to be more instant. That comes with more challenges because in olden times, back in the day, you'd have somebody who'd show up somewhere, and they'd have to actually learn about where they were before they could file their report. And now somebody shows up somewhere, and they can go on the air instantly, and they're expected to, and they may not know as much as you'd like them to know before they start reporting. So there's, you know, pluses and minuses to this all. We've talked about this before.
Times. Well, and it just seems that those that these trends, and we have talked about this before, but they're just get the magnitude just keeps over time. I'm still struck by the you talked about the CBS Evening News back in the day when you started there having a 50 share, and that means what, like half of all the television sets that are on are tuned to that
to Walter Cronkite
that show. The idea that would be, it's sort of stunning just to
I'll think tell you about the interesting statistic. And I believe this is right. I've not done any research on it, so somebody could end up proving me wrong, but I don't think they will. Color bars. You remember there was a day when you'd have to, when people would get their new color TV sets. I know my neighbor did this religiously. And he would wake up in the middle of the night because he would tune his color TV set because the networks fed out color bars. They had a technical reason for doing it. We won't go into it, but there were color bars on the network. And you would get your TV set, and you would tune your TV set so the color bars were there, because then your picture, your color picture, turned out well when you know, right, okay. The rating for color bars, the rating for those color bars is higher than for, like, MSNBC.
Well, there was nothing else
on.
Or CNN. There was nothing else.
No, but the rating for color bars. Listen, it's not like there was a lot being said that was interesting. And the rating for color bars was better than CNN's. You know, I mean, what does that say? Yeah.
The other thing that I think about it is how, and I'm sure that it wasn't quite this way when you were working with Walter Cronkite, but there was a time when, you know, he started doing television news when basically it was a guy at a desk with a microphone looking into the camera and reading copy.
That's Douglas Edwards, his predecessor. Yeah, I mean, you know, when Don Hewitt started producing the Evening News, that's what it was. It was David Inge sitting here with a piece of copy, and we put a camera on you, and go to it. It was radio that we broadcast. And then they said, well, we'll put some video, so it's a voiceover. And then we said, you know, we could have a correspondent, and couldn't they narrate some of that? And they narrated some of that. Douglas Edwards did the sinking of the Andrea Doria. I think it was the Andrea Doria where he was flying over it, and they actually, you know, did a news piece, one of the first news pieces done. It was pretty dramatic, and then it just grew, and you know, it got perfected. I was blessed the years that I worked with Walter for 7 years, and those 7 years were, I think, a real golden age for the evening newses and newses. They were great. We had great audiences. It was Watergate, and journalists were held in really high esteem. And it was before we screwed up. And it was a time when a lot of thought and care went into the crafting of these news packages that went on the air. And we did a lot of work towards explaining things to people. It was great. It was a wonderful time to be a journalist. And I think it really was a better time to be a journalist than now when, you know, now it's, you know, the big thing is, can I get that Skype interview? I don't know.
When was it? Now, I'm just curious. When would have been the first live satellite news report, like, you know, the first time that somebody was sitting there.
What was
there
the
and
first
saying,
thing ever said?
And now Rick Kaplan is in London, and he's now has, you know, and having the guy on.
Well, the big right I there. Remember the first, you know, the first satellite event that I can remember, and I was not in the business then, but the first satellite event that I can remember, and it's because I've seen video of it prior, was Edward R. Murrow, and he had Don Hewitt, who was directing, punch up in one broadcast. It was amazing. I think it was the Brooklyn Bridge or the Statue of Liberty. I think it was the Statue of Liberty in New York and the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And it was like, wow. And if you remember, when you first started tuning in, it would be like, we're going to go live to the street for our weatherman who's in front of the building. And I was like,
that
wasn't
was a big
that
deal.
Amazing?
That was a big deal.
I mean, we're actually live with our weatherman who's getting snowed on for real, live. And this was a big deal. And, you know, now it's like, really? You know, now you can go to the top of Kathmandu and it's okay, fine. I expect that. Yeah. It's just interesting how things have evolved.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Rick Kaplan. He is currently executive producer of This Week with Christian Amanpour on ABC television, also is heading up political coverage for ABC. He has had some other jobs at ABC, worked on Primetime Live, Nightline, worked with Peter Jennings on their evening news. He at one time was head of CNN US, was president of MSNBC, has done most of what there is to do in the television
news.
Now,
I might
business.
Have been executive producer of those shows, but I'm here to teach at the College of Media at the University of Illinois. Advertising students and journalism students. It's an extraordinary program. Jan Slater is dean. It's an up-and-coming school.
And he's there because he went to school here and has come back many, many times to work with students. And I'm sure that they appreciate having the opportunity.
Yeah, and I hear we have I hear the football team's doing pretty well.
Amazingly enough, undefeated so far. We'll see.
Yes.
We can maintain that.
I'm buying my tickets for Michigan, so when we play them and we're 7-0.
Questions are welcome about football or the news business. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Have you ever done sports? Have you been involved in broadcasting sports?
Was one of the producers for the Los Angeles Olympics.
Well, I thought I remembered you had something to do, because you've also, a lot of what you've done has been special events coverage, political conventions, you know, stuff.
Well, when I came to ABC, Rune Arledge, I came because Rune recruited me, and he mentored me, and I owe him, I would be selling hot dogs now if it wasn't for Rune. So he brought me, my first event, I came to ABC, and he brought me to Lake Placid, and I was working really hard, and he said, why don't you go relax, take the night off, here's two tickets, here's a ticket, go to the hockey game. I said, you know, I just don't really want to do this. I just don't want to do this. He said, well, go, relax, it'll be fine. I said, you know, we played the Russians last week, we lost like 17-4. I don't really want to sit in the stands and lose, you know, 20-1 or something. I'm not in the mood to get hammered by the Russians. He said, look, it's right on the ice. You're right in the middle. It's my seat. You know, it's Rune Arledge's seat. And so I said, oh, do I really have to do this? He said, go do it. So I got a ticket, and I sat right at the middle of the rink as we beat the Russians in the miracle game.
That hockey game.
Yes. And I sat there and I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm sitting at this game. And by the end of the game, I had no voice. I was crying. I mean, it was unbelievable. And Rune looked at me at the end of the game. He said, so did you enjoy yourself? You know, it was just great. So I went off and I did the Los Angeles Olympics with him and I did the wrap-up show. And the thing that was interesting is a guy from sales came up to me and said, you know, it'll never happen again, because everybody's going to have their own programs by the time we do the next Olympics. But at this Olympic game, the wrap-up show, we did the only wrap-up show, and we did it for the world. So this program that we did, we had 2 billion, with a B, 2 billion viewers for the show. And it was exciting as hell.
Yeah.
That's the Mary Lou Retton, and, you know, it was just an incredible Olympics.
I want to go back to something that you said a little earlier when you're talking about the way people think about reporters,
right,
and journalists, and how different it is now from the day from Walter's day. Are we ever going to get that back? And are we now just doomed forever to be scorned like so many other professions, you know, Wall Street bankers and shrinks?
I don't know. Maybe the language is coarser. The interactions that we have in our society are coarser, and you know, God knows, anybody can be a journalist. We're not like licensed, right? So anybody can be a journalist, and it doesn't take much to be a journalist. And there's just levels of, you know, there's journalists and journalists.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think there's always going to be people who bring credit to the profession and always going to be people who don't. And I think we'll be a controversial breed forever. Oh, it's tragic.
Well, maybe that's not so bad. I don't know.
No, I don't know. I guess not.
Yeah, no.
I guess not.
I got several callers here. Let me talk
Looks
with some
like
folks.
It.
Starting in, we'll take them in the order. They came in starting in with Champagne and line one right here. Hello.
Hi. Let me segue into what you were just talking about by asking you about a specific, I don't know if you will want to talk about it. Christine Amanpour, just in the past had Herman Cain on the program, and she used, an unsubstantiated story with about Rick Perry, about the N-word on a rock painted on a property which he bought, which supposedly they hadn't covered over, and then it turns out they did. But she used the unsubstantiated story without, you know, with anonymous sources to then question Mr. Cain for comments. And it seems to me that that's, especially when it turns out that the original unsubstantiated story was false based on evidence, it seems that's sort of playing dirty politics and dirty journalism. She got some statement, which is, of course, a statement based on what if a fictional story that she assumed was reality. So,
okay.
Well, I wonder if you could comment about that. Oh, do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, because it's the show we did this past Sunday, and I don't believe the story has been repudiated. I think the story is true. I think the deal. I think that Rick Perry hunted in an area. I'm not going to. You know, it's the N word,
yes.
And it's well known that that's what the area was called. The question really doesn't matter to me if the stone was painted over or not painted over. My understanding of it, and we said it on the show, is that it was painted over, but that. That was the area that and that's what it was called. And the question was, why didn't he have the name of the area changed? And, you know, what did he think about that? And, you know, if you're running for president, you have to be sensitive about that. And just what did Herman Cain, being an African-American, what did he think about that? I think it was legitimate, and we didn't dwell on it, but we spent a little bit of time talking about it. I think that was all fair game.
But it was anonymous sources about.
No, it actually is not anonymous sources. We talked to the Washington Post reporter. We talked with two of our people. We got a number of people who know exactly what went on there, and we did in fact run it down before we used it on the air.
But the sources in the Washington Post weren't listed as there were no name sources. There were no
Well, the key was. Is there a rock? Was it painted over? Is the area called what we said it was called? And did Rick Perry go there and hunt? And the Perry campaign itself did not argue with it.
That isn't the way it. Subsequent reports show that the rock had that name that Rick Perry's father and himself painted it over, tried to turn it over. And that it had that name before they leased the property, and they went to that area but the way it came out in the question was as if he was responsible for the name being there, and that he should have acted sooner to do something about the name painted on the rock, and then using that question to get Herman Cain to make comments. It seems to me that's dirty politics and dirty journalism. That's just my take on it.
Well, I appreciate the comment. I don't know if you want to do any more response than.
No, I think that I'm not aware of where he got that his information. My information is that what we did on the air stands up. So
why is that? I suppose then the question is, why is something like that important? Why does that matter?
I think the sensitivity is that if you're running for president, and that's the problem with running for president, you have to be extraordinarily careful that if you know what you join, where you go, how you live your life, you have to be, if you're going to run for president, you have to be very sensitive about who it offends, I'm not trying to be politically correct here. You have to be careful that you don't do things that are offensive to major parts of our populace. And if he's insensitive to it, blind to it, or remains blind to it, I mean, I think that's important. And hearing what other candidates and people have to say, I think is important. I think your caller is correct. If it's a cheap shot, it's not right. But this wasn't a cheap shot. And this is, he should, you know, go somewhere else. Texas is a big state. You don't need to hunt there. He leased this property. You could have made a big thing about changing, if that's what it was always called, you could have made a point about changing the name of it. And you could have made a point about changing the way the area is referred to and regarded. And he should have. Or what did you think of, you know, if you're a candidate, what did you think if he didn't go to some great lengths to do it? I mean, that's what I think.
Yeah, okay. Another call here, line two, Urbana. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This is a multi-part question here. The golden age of news where, you know, we had rock star writers, rock star radio broadcasters, rock star TV broadcasters, you know, everyone seems to look back at that and say, how can we get back to those types of times? How can we get back the Walter Cronkites, the Edward Murrows, and so on? And part of the reason for that seems to be because there was a lack of editorialization. There seems to be the image that they delivered, you know, straight news and let the viewer make the decision. Ted Koppel, I think, last year wrote an op-ed just regarding this this concept. But was that really the case that people weren't editorializing even back then, or was it that, you know, it just wasn't as obvious as it is today? And the other part of that question is, today, with all the different news outlets and all the different opinions and all the different people sort of fighting for the same small fraction of the ratings, is that a bad thing? Isn't that the marketplace of ideas? Like you said, journalism, you don't have to be a licensed person. Anyone can enter. There's no barriers to entry. Isn't that a good thing? Isn't that something that we should be excited about, that there's so many options, you know, so many people to choose from, and the viewer can make sort of their own decisions. We don't have some, you know, demigods. And don't get me wrong, you know, I loved Peter Jennings, but you know, that was one person that we sort of had to believe and had to, you know, take their word for it. So are we really in a worse place? That's my question. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
That's really good. I'm going to take the second part of his question first, mm-hmm. which is the audience component of your question. I think what makes me sad is that even though there are an enormously larger number of outlets, if you added up all those components, you know, the cable audience is not large. It's, you know, a couple hundred thousand here, a couple hundred thousand there. You add it all up. You know, when Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke at the UN and then he went on, I don't know, three or four cable shows, that audience added up was not even half the audience that he got by appearing with David Muir in a piece on World News Tonight. So what makes me sad is that the component, the size of the audience, is nowhere near, even though there's many more outlets, many more stations, MSNBC and CNN and Fox News and all the rest of that, even though there's many more channels now, if you add all those audiences up, they don't compare to what CBS, ABC, and NBC used to have. People were much more interested in the news, in broadcast news then, than they are now, which gets us to the first point, which is it because there aren't Huntley Brinkley's and Cronkites and Frank Reynolds and Peter Jennings and, you know, because we're missing those kind of people? Well, You know, I happen to have a great deal of respect for Brian Williams and for Scott Pelley and, of course, for Diane Sawyer. And there's a group of people behind them that are growing up in George Stephanopoulos and David Muir. And I will tell you, having worked very closely with all of these people, that a great deal of effort is spent making sure that opinion does not leak into what they have to say. I know they're always being yelled at for, you know, that you're telling us what to think, you're putting your opinion in. You know, I don't believe it. I don't buy it. And I don't think you can prove it. And it's a great catch line in a couple of cable channels. Well, one cable channel has made their reputation on accusing everybody else of having an opinion when clearly they do have an opinion. And unfortunately, one other cable channel has decided, well, we're going to have an opinion, and let's just go with it. So they blurred the lines. But basically, on the broadcast channels, the major anchors, I think, and those shows, they're very careful not to have an opinion, not to do it. And I think in time, I don't know, will we have another Cronkite? That's a function of, I think Brian Williams is and Diane Sawyer and Pelley and Scott Pelley are on track.
Yeah, that's maybe as close, given the fragmentation of the audience, given the fact that there are so many outlets for news, there are so many programs. It seems that, again, going back to what we talked about at the beginning, because no one ever is going to, unless there's some kind of extraordinary event, you know, and no one's ever going to have a 50 share on the newscast ever. Again,
yeah, see, and
no
that's
one's
going
to have that.
And that's what makes a Walter Cronkite, yeah. Isn't it? You have a 50 share. You know, all of a sudden, 30, 40, 50 million people are watching him. When you have 9/11 happen, that would have been a moment where a Walter Cronkite is created. But there's so much fragmentation that nobody had more than about 8 or 9 million people, 10 million people. And so nobody gets to be the heights of Walter Cronkite because they're sharing. Everybody's sharing audience. So it's hard. It's hard for somebody to really jump up and be that giant.
We'll talk some more with our guest here, Rick Kaplan, in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. This is Focus.
Annetta Brodsky, a deaf teen living in New York City, discovers the power of American Sign Language poetry as she prepares to be one of the first deaf poets to compete in a youth poetry slam. Our next community cinema, Deaf Jam, follows her journey leading to an unexpected collaboration. The free public screening is at the Maine Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, October 4th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon, 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll talk with Dr. Jonathan Gardner. He is the Deputy Senior Project Scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He's visiting the campus. We'll be giving some talks. His visit here sponsored by the Astronomy Department, and he'll be with us in the second hour. We'll talk about the Hubble Space Telescope, some of the important discoveries made possible by Hubble, and then the Webb, which astronomers hope will be launched in the next 5-6 years. Some big questions about funding for the project. We'll talk about what the latest is in the next hour. You can go back to listen to past programs, check on the schedule by going to our website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this... Oh, I'm sorry.
Tease.
Yeah, yes.
And you're talking about when they're going to launch, and I'm sitting here, and you looked at your watch, and I'm sitting and I'm going,
about 5 minutes from now.
So what are we launching? And then you go 5 or 6 years.
Five or six years.
What kind of a watch do you have there?
Well, it's I have a special dial here for big-time NASA events. For years. Well, yeah, you know, you got to look ahead in this business.
I love it.
Rick Kaplan is our guest this morning. He is... here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, where he went to school, has visited here many times to work with students, taking time away from his work. He right now is executive producer of This Week with Christiane Amanpour on ABC TV. He is also heading up political coverage at ABC. He has had a number of jobs in the broadcast news business. He worked for CBS. He's worked for MSNBC. In fact, he was president, right?
President of MSNBC and president of CNN.
And of CNN. And also, as we said, worked with a lot of very important people in the news business. Peter Jennings, Ted Koppel.
Katie Couric.
Walt Cronkite.
Diane Sawyer.
Just name a few.
Barbara Walters.
Knew the immortal
hold a job.
Rune Arledge, the man who taught us that you can wear a striped shirt and patterned tie together.
Together.
Questions, welcome.
333
WILL 9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll get back to the phones here. I have some folks here who have been patient with us. Somebody on a cell phone here, next line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A couple of questions. You said earlier in your introduction that before it all went south or it all went bad, what was the event or what was the tipping point there when it all went bad? And then the second part is, in the beginning of our country, we had tons of newspapers. Each individual newspaper had its own opinion, and they were deeply partisan and maybe only had a subscription base of 100 or something like that. And some were larger, some were smaller, some were, you know, whatever. And eventually they coalesced into major newspapers. Are we going to see the same kind of thing in on the web or in cable TV programming and such?
That's a good question. Yeah. All right. The I think what you mean by when did it go bad is that I assume when did it start to fragment?
I think we're talking about the way the public generally regards journalists, the news business. That somewhere we went from the way everybody loved Walter, to
exactly.
Now we're the people that they love to hate. Now, I mean,
I think there was a tipping point. I think when we started to cover news that people thought, you have got to be kidding me, and that's like the O.J. Simpson trial is a great example. Whoa. I think the O.J. Simpson trial is a great example of that. When we started to cover, with all the other stories that were going on in the world, all of a sudden we're dominating the world with O.J. Simpson coverage on major networks and all the rest, people started looking at us and going, you're just like the rest of them. You're not important. And when we started letting people down that way, and then when there started to be extraordinary numbers of other outlets, and when the internet came up and made you able to go anywhere you want to go, when you want to go it, and the anarchy of search became relevant, I think that's when it was like, you know what, I don't need you because you're not that important anyways. I think that's when it started to go. As for his newspaper question, which I find really interesting, because, yes, he's right. I mean, newspapers, when they began, were highly opinionated. I mean, they were out there to give an opinion and to push an opinion and to be partisan. And then they were conglomerated and made into larger newspapers, and you kind of evolved into an era of strong city newspapers, and those have now obviously all completely gone away. We're going to be we may be completely paperless in no time at all. It'll all go to the web. And of course on the web, you can have a newspaper. You could start a newspaper tomorrow. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything by coming up with the right banner and the right masthead and the right website and all. So yeah, I think that's in fact what is happened already. And it's just a matter of who can break through, and you have the brands that have already broken through, so that you do find the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal online, but you find some of the others like Politico and Huffington Post and the Daily Beast, and you find some of the other more, and Matt Drudge, and you find some of the other things that you're looking for, and sometimes, and I don't find some of the more obscure ones, but you know, there are websites that have 1,000 people who come and tune in and look at it. Politico is a very interesting site. I mean, Politico doesn't have millions of users, but the users that they have, the people that they have, are incredibly influential, and therefore Politico as a site if you want to know what's going on in politics, it's an extraordinary site to go to, and I recommend it to all of you. And again, it doesn't have millions of users, but the users it has are probably every member of Congress, every member of the media. I mean, it's where you go if you want to see what's doing.
Yeah. We're moving into our last 15 minutes. We have a number of callers. I just want to go ahead and give some more folks a chance to talk. Again, we'll have a cell phone person here, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great program. Thanks for taking my call. Very, very interesting. Just a couple of memories and maybe a comment or two for your guest. I'm in my mid-50s, and I can remember the nuns in grade school wheeling in the TV when Cronkite did the Gemini space shots, and that was all just fantastically interesting. And I think, as an observation, what we've lost with all the technology and the Internet is the sense of community that your guest talked about. You know, everyone watched the moon landing. There wasn't a lot of choices, and we were all kind of together, you know, even though we were in front of our TV screens. And
you're right.
You know, to extrapolate this out 25, 30, 40 years from now, I don't know, but I think everyone's going to have their own customized newscast when they want it and however they want it to look. But I was struck by just listening to the call-ins of a movie, 1976, Network. And I can remember when that came out and how far-fetched that seemed and just crazy off the top. And now, maybe not so far-fetched. And I was wondering, two quick questions. What does your guest think about the network news being driven now as entertainment? A couple of nights ago, I was watching network news, and they had a cat jumping up and down. It was on YouTube. And I'm thinking, okay, this is a national news. But everything is driven by, you know, video and the camera. And I was just wondering if you had any comments on that. And then going back to going to U of I, I was wondering what made him choose U of I, and is he in fact from Illinois, and if you had any observations about that. And I'll go ahead and listen up there. Thanks.
Sure, thanks.
Oh, my God. First of all, I mean, those are really astute observations, and yes, we are losing our sense of community, and that's what it was. That's really what it was all about. And actually, what made Walter Cronkite number one, Huntley and Brinkley were dominating the ratings. And I would like to point out, this is before my time. So I'm telling you things that I have been told by my mentors and by my predecessors. But in trying to figure out how Cronkite was going to pass Huntley and Brinkley, what they decided to do was get a bright, brilliant, actually, young producer named Bobby Wessler, and he took over the special events unit, and they said, you know what, the Apollo moonshots, they're a big deal. Let's just do those incredibly better than anybody else did. Walter Cronkite, and with Wally Sherrod his side, made the Apollo moonshot something unbelievably special, especially when a couple of them got in trouble and all the rest. And Cronkite came out of the Apollo so far ahead of Huntley Brinkley, he just never looked back. And it was because the country turned to Uncle Walter. And it was Uncle Walter. And it was a sense of community, and your caller is exactly right. As for me, I come from Chicago. I left and went to New York in 1971, and have never stopped loving the Cubs. My mother passed away at 91, and one of the last things she said to me is, you know, you would think that in my lifetime they could have made the World Series just once and won. And, you know, so what I suffer with the Cubs, I suffer with the Bulls, I suffer with the Bears, I suffer with the Blackhawks. Not always. I mean, every once in a while there's a sign of life. But it's really about the Cubs and the Bears for the most part. And sometimes the White Sox, because I was friends with Bill Veeck. So I love Chicago completely. Every New Year's I come back, all of my grammar, I'm still friends with a bunch of my grammar school friends. We've spent New Year's together since we're 13 years old, and we do it all together again at every New Year's, and all sneak into a movie theater, we don't sneak in the movie theater, but we sneak food in the movie theater. So we have a great time. So I'm a Chicagoan, born and bred, and I can't remember the other question you asked.
Well, the first job you had was at WBBM?
WBBM. TV? I started it. I walked into WBBM. I had been a speechwriter, an advance man for Gene McCarthy in 1968, and I walked in, and I'd been through, won't go into it here, but been through a lot, you know, with the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and, you know, and had been traveling nationally and had been doing a lot, and all I wanted to be was a copy boy, start in TV. And the news director, who has become a really good friend and is in charge of BBC Radio now in Boston, said, well, I don't think you have enough experience. And I looked at him, and I wanted to say, you are a fool. But I didn't say that because, you know, you never know. Good. And he's, as I said, he's become a dear friend. I start to walk out, and the kid who was the copy boy locks himself in the wire room. You know, we used to have the teletypes, you know, where you where the paper would actually come out, and you would type the news on it. And one of the jobs of the copy boy would be to change the ribbons, which was a really messy, inky, icky kind of thing.
I've done it. We had a teletype. It was like a typewriter.
Oh, it's a typewriter. It was a typewriter, and it was just horrible. In any event, in WBBM, it was in a room because it made so, you know, it had six or seven wire machines, made a hellacious noise. And so it was in a room, and the door, for some reason, was put on backwards, so it locked from the inside. And this kid had locked himself in the wire room, was having a nervous breakdown. They couldn't get the new news on the air because all the news was in the room and the kid had locked himself in. And we stopped. I stopped and a bunch of people stopped and we're looking and the kid's having a nervous breakdown. It's tragic. I mean, he's yelling and all the rest. They can't do the new news. They have to go on the air and they can't do the news. They don't have copy. So they bring, you know, they're reading copy from the morning and kind of making it up for 15 minutes. And the fire department comes, and they are taking hinges. I mean, I'm standing there. It's a train wreck, so I'm watching it, and they're taking hinges off the door. And they actually go in, and they gently put him in a straitjacket and take him out, carry him out. Oh, it was an amazing scene. Bruce Roberts was there. Remember the guy who did sports? Yeah. I'm just standing there watching, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, did I dodge a bullet not getting a job here? And I'm starting to walk out, and Bob yells at me, Rick. And I go, yes. He says, do you think you could start tomorrow? And I forgot all the downsides of working there. And I said, you got it. And so for $83 a week, a memo came out, and I started WBBM. And that's how I got in the business.
That is a great story. We have a couple of other callers here, about 5 minutes. No, don't apologize. We'll go to line one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Kaplan.
Hi.
Do you think ABC Network coverage of the recall movement in Wisconsin and also the one in Ohio has been adequately covered? I'll listen offline here.
You know, I can't answer that question because I was not at ABC. I've only been there 16 weeks, and I was at CBS News then. I thought we did a really good job at CBS News of the recall coverage. I don't know what ABC did at all. I have no knowledge of it, so I'm really sorry. So how's that for a lame answer?
That's fair. Let's go to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, just a question. It seems to me, I don't know if my perceptions are accurate because I kind of stopped watching TV, but get my news mostly from radio. But back when I did, it seems like I'd always found it curious that independent news agencies can always come up with the same lead story. It seems like it'd be more natural that if you're, you know, independent, you'd find different lead stories, and each day we'd have three or four, how many news stations having different leads, but they all seem to be the same lead story, and I was wondering if there's any particular reason behind that, or how does that occur, and why, and I'll listen offline.
Well, actually, I think that we would like not to have the same lead story, quite frankly. We call, you know, my boss likes to have what's called, what he calls an insurgent lead. You know, let's find something different for people to tune into. But I don't think it's strange at all. I mean, if you asked 100 learned people in a room, what's the main story today? What's the big story today? I would bet that 95 out of those 100 people would say jobs. So would it be strange if there was a story going out, you know, the jobs report came out, everybody led with jobs. It would be strange if they didn't. So I always find that the only time that I find it strange is when there's not those kinds of deliberate leads and we come up with the same story. I mean, you're looking for the most important story, and most days it's pretty clear what the most important story is. On days when it's not, I think you find now more often than not the evening news is do vary more than they used to, because everybody's trying to find a different hook to get people to watch them. You know, we're doing, they're doing the jobs and we're doing weather and the other guy is, you know, it just, you're looking for something different.
About 5 minutes or so left in this part of Focus, talking with Rick Kaplan. He's here. He's a graduate of the U of I, here working with journalism students, as he has done many times. Currently, 17 years. Currently, he's working for ABC as executive producer of This Week with Christian Amanpour and also directing their political coverage. And as we've mentioned, he worked at CNN, MSNBC, ABC. Never at PBS, never in public.
Can't hold a job. What can I tell you? It's really sad.
That's a problem. Your earlier caller talked about what was happening with newspapers, and newspapers are in really a tough spot, and they're looking for some kind of new model. It used to be that they could support themselves through what they charge for classified ads, which they have lost. A lot of that revenue they've lost it to the Internet. The habit of newspaper readership seems really to be declining, so they're not selling as many physical papers. I suppose some people are reading it on the web, but then for papers, the question is, okay, well, what are we can't keep giving it away, even though most everybody is. And the big test case seems to be the New York Times that put up a paywall and started charging people for unlimited access to the paper. And I think, I'm not sure that, you know, the jury has ruled on that, whether that's working for them or not. Do you think that we're going to be moving more to a model for whoever is putting out the news, some kind of a pay-per-read, pay-per-view, something like that?
Well, you know, it costs money to cover the news well. It costs money to do this work, and nobody gets a free ride. And I think that ultimately this current model of I mean, I like the idea of holding a paper in my hands, the idea that I can sit down on Sunday with the New York Times and go through the Sunday New York Times. I mean, I really relish that. But for a lot of people, and especially a lot of young people, and look, I get up in the morning and I read all my papers online because I need to be done with it early and I don't have time to wait and, you know, do that in the office. And for a lot of young people, they're perfectly happy reading it online. So what I tell them is, the current model of going to a newsstand and buying newspapers, that may be dying and be dead at some point in the future. But newspapers, I don't think, will be dead at all. And in fact, somebody asked me yesterday in one of the lectures whether, for instance, the Sunday New York Times Magazine, will that be dead? And I went, no, I mean, I think it'll be healthier than ever, except it'll be different. They won't be dead. They'll just be different. You'll be... In the Times Magazine, for instance, you know, you'll be writing articles. There'll be a benefit because you won't be limited necessarily to 5,000 words. It's online. You can go 6,000 words. It's not going to cripple anybody. And you can have you can have hotspots within your article so that you can direct people to things and have people. You can make it a much more satisfying experience because you can link to other articles and other things while you're doing this piece. I think there's a whole world out there for newspapers and magazines to really evolve. I think it will be on paid tiers, and I think people will get used to it. This is a real transition period for media. I think we're sitting here in 10 years and great journalistic operations will exist, but they'll be on protected pay tiers that you will pay for. Yeah. Because do you really expect all these great journalists to do it for nothing? You mean we're going to be sending people all around the globe and having camera crews and anchors and correspondents and you're not going to have to pay for it? It just doesn't work that way.
Well, the big question then is will people do it?
Will people
pony up, and to what extent they will, and how much? And then will they say, okay, I have this media budget, and I got to pay for my cable TV, and I got to pay for my cell phone, and I got to pay for this, and then I got to pay for that.
Well, you'll pay for it in that same way. I mean, if you pay, do you have cable?
Yeah.
Do you watch ESPN?
No, actually, I don't, but really? I pay for it anyway.
Do you know how much you pay for it?
I don't know, a couple dollars probably.
Couple?
No, honestly, no, I don't.
What? How much do you think you pay for it?
How much was it? $3.
Yeah,
a month.
You're not even close. And you don't watch it. You'll
How much
pay,
am I
You'll
paying
pay for the news. I'll tell you off air.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you off air. But you're paying, you know, you're paid for CNN. And you know what? If you didn't have CNN and ESPN and some of these things on your cable, you wouldn't get it.
Well, that's well.
And in the same way as they see as it all migrates, there'll be a Disney tier, and what will be in that tier? We own ESPN, so it'll be ESPN, it'll be ABC, it'll be a whole bunch of other properties. Maybe we'll partner with the New York Times. Maybe we'll Yahoo will be up there. And there'll be all kinds of reasons to go into that tier.
See, the thing I think I guess the thing that I would be okay with would be let's do it a la carte. I would be okay paying for a channel if I was actually watching it, but I don't watch the Home Shopping Network and I don't watch ESPN.
Yeah, but you
and
don't
watch a lot of other stuff.
You don't pay much. Yeah, I mean, for the Home Shopping Network, you might not pay at all because the Home Shopping Network might pay to be on
to
your
be
cable.
On there. Okay,
but. Okay. You know, ESPN, you'd be surprised what you pay for ESPN. And HBO, you watch HBO?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You pay for HBO.
I don't have much of a life,
you
really.
You pay, yeah, you don't have it, David. Jeez.
It's true. We can talk about it afterwards. I think we're just about at the point we have to
launch that telescope.
Wrap it up. Yeah, I got a telescope I got to launch
gotta
in about 5 years.
He needs money. NASA needs money. That, I mean... You know, when we get into tough budget times like these, the first people who get really screwed are people like all those NASA people.
Well, this very project, the Webb, the people in the House would like to cut the money for that completely.
It's easy. Yeah. The arts get killed. He gets killed. I mean, it's just amazing what we kill. And and ultimately, it's incredibly short-sighted because there are so many benefits. He'll love this. There are so many benefits to funding our space exploration and our Hubble telescopes. We get so much out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just short-sighted. But, you know, when time is tough, we need to put people to work. We need Congress to talk to each other.
Rick Kaplan is our guest. He's executive producer of This Week with Christiane Amanpour on ABC Television, also in charge of their political coverage, has done a lot of other things in broadcast TV, and is currently here spending time with journalism students.
So how much trouble did I get in today, and do you think I'll have a job tomorrow?
I think so. And anyway, you know, you can always get another one.
There you go.
Thank you very much for being
here. Thank
you. We appreciate
it. My pleasure. ESPN, you'd be surprised what you pay for ESPN. And HBO, you watch HBO?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You pay for HBO.
I don't have much of a life, really.
You pay. Yeah, you don't have it, David. Jeez.
It's true. We can talk about it afterwards. I think we're just about at the point we have to
launch that telescope.
Wrap it up. I got a telescope. I got to launch in about 5 years.
He needs money. NASA needs money. That, I mean, you know, when we get into tough budget times like these, the first people who get really screwed are people like all those NASA people.
Well, this very project, the Webb, the people in the House would like to cut the money for that completely.
It's easy.
Yeah.
The arts get killed. He gets killed. I mean, it's just amazing what we kill. And ultimately, it's incredibly short-sighted because there are so many benefits. He'll love this. There are so many benefits to funding our space exploration and our Hubble telescopes. We get so much out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just short-sighted. But, you know, when time is tough, we need to put people to work.
We
need Congress to talk to each other.
Rick Kaplan is our guest. He's executive producer of This Week with Christiane Amanpour on ABC Television, also in charge of their political coverage, has done a lot of other things in broadcast TV, and is currently here spending time with journalism students.
So how much trouble did I get in today, and do you think I'll have a job tomorrow?
I think so. And anyway, you know, you can always get another one.
There you go.
Thank you very much for being
here.
Thank you. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
We can take a break here. When we come back, we will, in fact, be talking about space telescopes, the Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope with Dr. Jonathan Gardner from NASA. First, though, we'll take a break so we can bring you an update on the markets and news. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/FarmerView.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. We're at mid-session. Future prices in the commodities significantly lower. A lot of traders talking about what the latest out of Greece might mean for outside markets. Grain futures down 2% today. fears from the traders that Greece could default on its debt and then eventually trigger a widespread global meltdown in terms of economies all across the world. Corn has its biggest monthly decline in 15 years in September, and it's extending those losses. And soybeans are facing additional headwinds from the harvest, which is expected to pick up late this week and early into next week as well. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat at